Hi, this is Patrick Ma from Simple Cider in Tasmania, and you're listening to Cider Chat.
Episode number 88. That is the sound of a snorting kangaroo. We're headed to Tasmania this week, and we're going to be in the land of marsupials like kangaroos, wallabies, and the Tasmanian devil. A kangaroo can weigh as much as 130 pounds or 60 kilograms. A wallaby is a smaller version of a kangaroo and ranges around 7 pounds and probably a little bit higher. All in all, it's a majestic landscape, and we'll be speaking to Patrick Mayer of Simple Ciders in Tasmania about the land, the cider, and the culture in this episode of Cider Chat. Hello and welcome to a Cider Chat. My name is Aria Windcaller, and I am the producer and the cider MC on this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. And this week, our chat is with Patrick Mayer of Simple Ciders in Tasmania. There's going to be more on that chat in just a moment. I'm not going to worry about it. No way. This is the middle of the summer where we are. We're going to be talking soon with Patrick, who is in the middle of the winter. That is like the yin and yang of the universe, and you just got to roll with the planet. And there might be a reason then why the apple is round. Well, we're going to catch up here with a little bit of an email that I got from a fellow by the name of Joby, who's so supportive of this podcast in so many amazing ways. And he sent me this email over the weekend, and I'm going to just kind of parcel it out to you because I think there's some cool stuff. Joby definitely says that he listens sometimes to some of the episodes 3 or 4 times. And that just makes me scratch my head and say, wow, you know, and not only does he listen to it, but he gets things out of it that I don't, maybe because I'm approaching it from a different direction, which is super interesting because there's so many different reasons why we are part of Ciderville and enjoying cider. And one thing that you might like, I might really dig too, or vice versa. Anyways, let me go in here, and I want to talk about some of the things he was talking about with his experiment with wild yeast, and he's blending multiple batches of the same juice, different yeast for some more flavor profiles and what he calls dancing on the tongue. And some of the tips that he noticed definitely helped with his 2016 ciders versus others in the past. And the first one was when using a natural or wild yeast, he adds 30 parts per million of sulfites. And he's found that it knocks off the very early yeast that can often leave funky flavors, but yet it lets some of the other yeast do their thing for flavor complexities. That's kind of interesting. I'm going to get back to that. And then he also mentioned that he does regular testing after primary fermentation. I wonder, Joby, does regular testing mean tasting? I would hope so. So he does regular testing after primary fermentation during aging so that he keeps around 25 parts per million of free SO2 to help with the critters that can cause off flavors. So he's really monitoring, in essence, he's monitoring his cider throughout the process, which is something that we should all do. And yet life takes us away, especially if we're not a commercial cider maker. So I want to go on. I'm going to go on a little bit and then I'll get back to what he's saying there. He writes that he chuckled pretty good on the Charles McGonigal chat. And there was 2 chats with Charles actually just a couple episodes ago. Let me find out which one those are that he's referring to. That would be episode number 83 and 84. when Charles talked about dry pitching and using no sulfites for a combination of cultivated and wild yeast. Joby used to do that for years, especially early when I didn't know much and was kind of lazy and didn't feel like the added steps of adding sulfites, waiting, rehydrating the yeast, and then pitching was really like in his best interest. He stopped doing that last year on his cultivated yeast batches because so many people said you have to rehydrate and you must knock out those wild yeast. And he noticed that those batches were not as good as years past when he used the juice from the same fruit and orchard and the same yeast. He mentions that Charles says that he prefers this method, that, you know, you're pitching the yeast and not adding any sulfites at all. And he also said that Charles mentioned that the Nottingham, and that's where Charles and I were talking about cider, and I mentioned that I use the Nottingham, and Charles said it's a bad ale yeast for cider. I'm not sure if he actually said it was a bad ale yeast, but he just said it's an ale yeast. And Joby tried it on a batch, and while tasting during aging, found that it had some actually really nice bready and yeasty flavors that you get from the first sip of a foamy, like, head of beer. So it became his first hop cider, and it was fantastic. You know, I totally agree with his next sentence, which was that it's so amusing that there's so many different cider methods and advice that conflict with each other, but they all seem to work. And I agree. So I want to get back to that piece. And I think this is what Joby's talking about, which I have done for years, specifically because I was teaching cider making and I was doing that outdoors. And I wanted to show immediately how you pitch the yeast and get your cider rolling. And that means that I'm not going to allow it to sit overnight. I take the juice fresh off the press and I would pitch my dry yeast. And that would be like a little packet. Put it right in there and then bring it home and let it come up to temperature. And there is a lot of talk about a slow fermentation. And that's the one thing that I've changed over the years. I actually still do this method. I don't even pitch any sulfites at all. I still pitch it directly to that fresh juice, even though it's cold. So it could be way below like 60 degrees. I pitch it straight away. And then now, instead of like putting it next to my wood stove, which I really used to dig and I used to like record the sound and the bubbling airlocks, now I don't. I let it come up to temperature slowly. And there is a little bit of like the wild yeast kind of competing with the cultivated yeast. And I just let it go. And may the best yeast win. And that's kind of my sense of, one, really appreciating the local terroir and trusting in the yeast. I think there's so much trust that has to happen with the apple. And if we follow the apple, it will bring us down the right path. Sure, there's going to be, you know, maybe some funkiness that comes out of it, but I like funky, if you haven't been noticing, with some of the music selections that I've been playing with. And the complexity of that like little tinge of wild yeast there. And actually in this chat this week with Patrick, he's going to talk about that too. He's actually using a bit of the wild yeast and cultivated yeast too for the simple ciders. So that was pretty interesting because I did try the same thing that Joby did where I thought, oh, everybody's telling me, you know, you got to throw in your pectin enzymes, you got to do your sulfites. And you could do this. You could do all this if you really want to like control your cider. And I think some cideries want to do that because they're trying to do a consistent process. But if you are a non-commercial cider maker, like probably a lot of listeners here who want to try everything out there, you could definitely go for it. And don't worry about what sometimes being told to you. If it feels right, do it. that is the way. Like if your body's moving that direction, keep on going with it. If the apple is falling down the hill, then run down and catch it and pick it up, pop it in that little carboy and let it roll. So avoiding the sulfites is something that I do straight away. And, you know, there's going to be natural sulfites that are occurring. And if you want to listen to more about Charles's hit on that, definitely go back to those two episodes that I mentioned earlier. That was episode 83 and 84. And you could hear him kind of speak quite a bit on that. But a lot of us, we're not doing that. We're just going by taste and a sense of what is right. So I'm with you, Joby. I do the same thing even today. I pitch my yeast straight away, and then I let it slowly bring up the temperature, let the two yeasts go at it, and see what I like. Now, I'm actually doing something a little bit different this coming year, because I have the cider press that I talked about in a recent episode. I think that was episode 86. And because of that, I imagine I'm going to have a lot more juice available, because I'll be able to do it on my own time. And there's a huge bumper crop in my spot of Ciderville. And I'm going to be having the use of a barrel. I'm getting a barrel, and I'm super excited about that. Local brewery is getting rid of some barrels, and I'm going to be picking up a 25-gallon oak barrel that did have whiskey, and then it had beer in it. Now, I have to admit, I'm not a big fan of, like, intense whiskey-flavored ciders, even though that's kind of almost like a traditional thing here in New England, where folks would be adding spirit and keeping the whiskey barrel, because I think it could get really, really sour. So it's going to be quite a little balancing act for me, and I'm sure I'm going to get more of appreciation of managing that barrel. And I have a buddy of mine who's going to be getting a barrel too, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from him and how he goes with it. But what I'm going to do in that case, as I'm planning ahead for the fall, and that's what we want to be doing now, is planning ahead on getting all our like little tools of cider making, such as the press or the carboys and the airlocks, or start planning for the yeast that we want to work with. In this case, I'm going to be pressing the apples. I'm going to let the wild yeast go. I'm not going to pitch any yeast in there at all. And I'm going to have about 20, 25 gallons of that, because I have this huge mother of all carboys. It's actually 20 gallons. I'm a little intimidated by it. I've never used it because it's so damn big. I think I'm going to need a hoist to do it, but I'm going to use it somehow. Oh my gosh. Oh, that's going to be big. I'll definitely be taking all of you along on that and showing you some photos. So anyways, I'm going to use this giant glass vessel that's 20 gallons. Let it go wild. I'll be racking it off a couple times. I'll leave it on the lees, and I'm going to be keeping that separate from the barrel for a while. And then at the very end, I'm going to put it into the barrel and see how it goes. Now, I'm also going to probably, in the meanwhile, while I'm doing that, also have another 25 gallons sitting in the barrel. So I want to do like a face-to-face. This is all dependent, mind you, on getting enough juice. And it's going to be a little bit of labor. So we'll see how it all works out. But by apple by apple, we'll get there. And it should be a lot of fun to just see how this all kind of plays out. And, for like a novice cider maker like myself, I've only been doing it for about 20 years. So I have a long way to go learning how to make cider and enjoying it. And I figure, what do I have to lose? I could kind of doctor it up on the other side if I need to. Why not? And probably be kegging it. So that'll be fun. And I'll keep you posted on that. I always appreciate emails. You could send me one, Rhea@ciderchat.com. And if you have little tidbits that you're doing and finding that are valuable, or you find a little tip from listening to this podcast, please do send them along. And a big tip of the glass to Joby and to all of you today out there in Ciderville. Now we're going to head on to this chat, this main chat with Patrick, and I'll be right back with that in a moment. So this is a very good time to go out and get your glass, or if you're driving or riding that bike somewhere, just keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road, and we'll meet you on the other side of this little break here and head right on to Simple Ciders in Tasmania.
Been driving down 495, watching the skies turn to gold. We believe in dollar signs, you can't leave yourself behind, growing old. You really can't get there without wasting all your days. You really won't get there till you come home to stay. such thing as time. It's all right.
That was Emma Ayers singing her song, Route 3. She's been on the podcast before, most recently on episode 70 with Maddie Beeson of Black Twig, a cider house in North Carolina. There'll be some links in the show notes on how you can find out more about Emma. Just a lovely voice, and I kind of picked that song because, well, you know, that feeling of you can't really get there without wasting time, it could feel a little bit like the way it is to make cider. There's the whole life cycle of the cider scene, isn't there? The beginning of the year, the end of the year. And sometimes you feel like, man, I'm just kind of wasting time. And she's singing a little bit about kind of like singing on the street, probably with a guitar case open and just trying to keep it going and get her voice be heard. And imagine for a lot of the commercial cider makers out there, you have that same kind of feeling. I know I do as a podcaster, just trying to get our voices heard and our product known. And sometimes it feels like you're treading in water, but tread we do, and we just kind of have to keep our feet moving and our eye on the prize. Speaking of eye on the prize, we're now going to head to Simple Ciders in Tasmania. This chat was recorded earlier and about a couple weeks ago, really, right after I got a nice big old box that came in from Tasmania with two amazing bottles of this cidery's product. I'll be talking to Patrick about that, along with a little Tasmanian Devil, which you heard earlier, and a great picture book of the Apple Isle. And the cider scene in Tasmania is really starting to roar. So let's all now grab a glass and join this chat with Patrick Mayer of Simple Ciders in Tasmania. You're in the kind of like the middle of your winter or almost in the middle of the winter. What's the season like right now?
Oh, it's just coming to the end of autumn. Tomorrow is actually the first day of winter.
Oh, tomorrow.
But, there's snow snow on the mountain already.
Really? And when does it start snowing on the mountains? When do you start seeing that?
We're very lucky down here in Tasmania. Sometimes it snows on the mountain in the middle of summer, but from about here through to about September, we'll see snow pretty constantly or regularly on the mountain.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wanted to thank you for that booklet that you sent of Tasmania by Steve Parrish. And it's just a beautiful kind of picture illustration and also with the information of the area. And I was looking at the map of Tasmania, which kind of like in the way they present it, it looks a little bit kind of like a heart. You know, it's a little bit of a heart shape. What end of Tasmania are you actually located? And are you by the coast?
We are about 30 k's in from the coast, and we are down on the southern tip of Tasmania.
Southern tip, okay. Is it agricultural in your area? Are there a lot of orchards and farms? What's it like?
We're very much in apple country. The whole island is called the Apple Isle. Where we grow our fruit was, as far as the eye could see, you know, 50, 60 years ago, it was all apples. There's been a little bit of a regression, but it's the best apple country that I know of.
And you've been in the apple scene for a while now. Is this something that, let's talk about your roots in cider and apple. Tell us a little bit of that history.
I started making cider just for myself about 10 years ago and just loved doing it, loved playing around with it, you know, made all the mistakes that everyone makes, and then, you know, decided that I would pursue it professionally. I was already a winemaker and it seemed like a reasonable transition to make. So myself and my family moved to Tasmania about 4 years ago, and we started up Simple Cider about 3 years ago.
Was this what you originally thought you were going to be doing when you were, you know, a few years younger, I suppose, growing up and thinking, I want to become a cider maker? You were in wine. Was that professionally?
Yes. Yeah, I was a professional winemaker.
Ah.
And when I was younger, I always loved cider, loved wine, loved making things like that. But I initially was doing a systems analysis and financial things, and then really didn't like being an office worker and looked for a job that allowed me to get really messy, cold and wet on a regular basis. And so I went into making wine and cider.
Hmm. And I know that region, it was called the Apple Isle, but there's also a lot of wine in general, both in Australia is known, you know, world famous for the wine. Tasmania, what is the relationship between the grape growers and the apple growers at this point? What are you seeing? Has there been a change, or has it been pretty steady over the past couple of years?
It's a pretty small community down here, and everyone likes to sort of play along with each other. We work hand in hand with each other. You know, obviously we make a different product, but there's a lot of conversation between the two sort of sectors. You do find a lot of winemakers making cider and vice versa, and the same with brewers as well. There's a lot of brewers who are making cider and vice versa.
So you've been in this for a little bit now. I originally met, was it Sam in Chicago at CiderCon, and that's how we kind of got connected.
That was my good friend Tom.
Oh, Tom.
Who was working with me for a couple of years.
Okay, Tom, right. And so
Tom's awesome.
Yeah, I know. That was incredible. And he said, well, I have a friend in Tasmania. I'm like, I would love to talk to him. That's fantastic. Let's talk a little bit about your particular ciders. I have two bottles here in front of me. And one is the Cox Orange Pippin. And the other is the Granny Smith and Ginger. So that Granny Smith and Ginger, that's, you're kind of adding a little bit of a spice to it with the ginger. Is that unusual to see something other than just purely apples in cider making in your region right now? Or is that something that's new coming in, people being innovative in that way?
There is a lot of diversity. There's a lot of innovation. They're not really held back by, you know, centuries of history and so on. So, you know, basically we're just trying to make the best product we can and, you know, something that people really enjoy. So we are seeing some people down here using different combinations of fruit and so on. Some people experimenting with using hops. And, of course, we use the ginger, which we use to soften out the really bright and crisp acid that the Granny Smith apple has.
Are your apples sourced from a nearby orchard, or are you an orchard-based cidery?
We are an orchard-based cidery. Our apples move about 150 meters to where we make the cider.
Wow. So this was a location that you moved to from somewhere. You weren't on Tasmania. I say on Tasmania. It's not really an island, but, you know, looks like one on the map. I know it's really large. And you are growing, how many, is it, hectares of apples?
Well, my partner, the orchardist, he grows some for the market as well. So I think we're growing about, not too much, about 5 to 10 hectares.
That's a good amount. Not bad at all. When we look at a hectare, I think it's a little over 2 acres, if we transfer it that way. I'll make sure I fill that in. So can you give us an idea of what your cidery actually looks like? You're orchard-based. Do you have your cidery in a barn? Are you in like a underground type of situation, like a basement? What's the setup there?
Well, I'd love to be in an underground situation with a fully developed natural cave. But we are very lucky. We are in a reclaimed packing shed. The Huon Valley has grown apples for over 100 years, and our trees are over 100 years old. But when the apple industry sort of changed about 30 years ago, a lot of the packing sheds stopped being used. So we've reclaimed the packing shed that's on the orchard, and we make our cider out of that. And it's great because it's a pre-made, insulated building, really lovely, constant temperature, beautiful. It's a great place to work.
And what is the amount of cider that you're making right now per year? And are you pressing year-round, or do you press all your apples at once?
At the moment, we're very much in the growth phase. We've only been going for a couple of years. We'll make between sort of 10 and 15,000 litres this year. I'm not sure how much that is in gallons. We process through about 6 months of the year. The Cox's Orange Pippin needs to be processed all at once, but the Granny Smith apples tend to hold out a little bit more. There are some other apples that we're processing. And we also make a cherry drink, which we have to process pretty quickly in January.
What is a cherry drink? Is that like a cider with a cider base with cherries added?
It is. It has a tiny bit of cider base, but it is mostly cherry. It's super interesting. It's super fun. It's completely wild fermented, no preservatives whatsoever. It takes a really long time to make. It has a lovely little sweetness from some non-fermentable sugars. It's super fun. It just takes a really long time to make.
Well, I was wondering about that because cherries normally get pitted right before they are fermented. Or is that what you're doing? Are you taking the pit out of the cherry?
No, we actually we're using a lot of carbonic maceration, okay. And then we're doing some foot stomping, and then we're doing some light pressing with the basket press. We try to crush up the fruit as little as possible. We still get a pretty decent extraction, but what we wanted, you know, in addition to, you know, really lovely strong cherry aroma, was some nice tannins, which, you know, cherries have in abundance, which allow us to do it without the preservatives and so on. It's amazing juice, and it just stays together so well.
You're making cider now as a cider maker, and you have this wine background. What tools from your wine knowledge are you bringing forward into your cider making? And, you know, there's there's like leaving the cider on the lees, like batonnage. Are you doing anything like that to really kind of pull out some tannins and deepen the profile of that cider?
We do that a little bit, but you know, I try to be clear in my mind that I'm working with something entirely different. I mean, if I was to make cider exactly the same as wine, I think it would be kind of boring. I let the fruit sort of dictate what treatment it wants. The technical skills, like how to use the machines and so on, that's basically what I take across from my winemaking background.
Well, there's so much that kind of goes hand in hand there. So I'd like to ask you about, you're mentioning wild yeast. Is that something that you primarily only do with the cherry? And are these two ciders in front of me right now, are those made with wild yeast, or are you using a cultured yeast for the most part with your ciders?
In all of our products, there is a component of wild yeast. We think that it makes for a much more interesting, complex, round, funky product. We try to let everything start super slowly, maybe delay inoculation with a cultured yeast, in addition to having components that are just solely wild yeast. We think, you just get a lot more, and we're lucky enough, the fruit comes such a short distance, and your fruit is the story, and the yeast and so on that come from the orchard, that's our story. So we don't want to we want to take advantage of that as much as we can.
Absolutely, yeah, well said. I'm wondering then, you're saying you're doing like a slow fermentation. At what temperature do you work with for that initial fermentation?
We aim to sort of ferment between, is it okay if I talk in Celsius?
Yes,
try to work.
Yes.
At 14 to 18 degrees. We really like to keep it as cool as possible. We're not concerned about rushing it through or speed. We want to keep as much of the aromatics as possible. We don't want to have any stress and so on. We're quite happy for it to go nice and slowly.
Mm-hmm. So that's around 60 degrees Fahrenheit. And what type of vessels are you fermenting in and conditioning your cider?
We're mostly using stainless steel at the moment. We're going to source some barrels later in the year, but for the moment we're mostly using stainless steel.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the barrels. Is that something that you would like to start doing, or have you done any barrel aging?
I have not done any barrel aging with the cider thus far. I would really like to have a look at it because, barrels do wonderful things. They allow for some, beautiful convection and, great contact with the lees, which might allow for some more roundness. Plus, of course, you're going to get some extraction from the oak, some beautiful kind of lactones and what have you, give a nice sort of thing. I wouldn't want it to be the dominant character, though, which because I want the fruit and the aroma of the fruit to be the primary characteristic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm hearing that about. I could really feel your passion for that, and that's really exciting for me to hear that. Now, in terms of making the cider and developing that fruit, you're fermenting it a little bit of that wildness. When you're doing the yeast, what are you looking for with like that yeast profile? If you're adding a cultured yeast, are you trying to bring it out as like a champagne kind of style, or each of these bottles say dry apple cider? So what would a person, and I'm going to open one of these bottles really shortly here, but what would they be expecting to get from a bottle of simple cider?
They would be expecting to get a nice, lightly sparkling, very dry, bottle conditioned cider that doesn't have a building, cloying sweetness, tastes of apples, smells of apples, hopefully a really nice drink.
Mm-hmm. Well, your branding is really nice. Let me explain that to Ciderville, the bottle that I have in front of me. I'm holding the Cox Orange Pippin, and the cap itself is a crown cap, which is all white, and the label is white, and then your logo and the name of your cider is simple, written out in like cursor, then there's a little apple at the end and cider underneath. And it is a very simple and clean label. And, that That's a lot right there. That kind of tells you a lot of your attention to detail. I'm going to actually open this bottle right now and try a little bit of Tasmania all the way here in my side of Ciderville. They had a nice little fizz there. You're probably not drinking cider right now this early in the morning, are you? Let's see.
Not just yet.
Yeah. Okay, so it's pouring.
Which one did you open?
I opened up the Cox Orange Pippin. And just nice little bubbles there. Small little bubbles that you would expect from like that bottle conditioning. Oh, it's like a lovely, I wouldn't normally say this about an orange pippin, but it has like an orangey, like, scrumptiousness to it. Really a floral, but not over floral or too fruity in a way that would be cloying. Exactly as you described. Spot on, Patrick. Really delightful cider. Brilliant, brilliant in clarity. Next up, I asked Patrick about filtration because the clarity of this simple cider was so absolute. And his reply got a little staticky. So I'll tell you what he said. Indeed, they do not filter because they're doing a bottle conditioning. They leave it on the lees a bit. And all they do primarily are about one or two initial racks of the solid, or what you might call the lees. If you're not familiar with what racking means, it's essentially where you siphon off the liquid off of the lees. So that's called racking. You rack the cider over, or you rack the wine over, or you rack the beer over. And it's a very common phrase because this is happening quite a bit during the fermentation. Now let me just remind you about what a lee is, and that's spelled L-E-E-S. It is essentially the dead yeast cells that are found on the bottom of the vessel. And there's something called surlee aging, which is on the lees, and that's very common in white winemaking. And there's two different kinds of lees. It's the initial first drop of the really heavy, heavy participants. Those are the gross lees. That's G-R-O-S-S. Like, oh, that's gross. And you find it, you know, right after that first, like, fresh pressing of apple juice, even if you have some fresh, sweet cider in your little like plastic jug. If you're in the U.S. and you went to a cider mill, you leave that in your refrigerator a little bit and you're going to get some gross lees on the bottom there. It's just going to, the heavy participants are going to drop down. And then there's something called the fine lees. And that's after you do the first rack after the initial fermentation and you have that fine little sediment on the bottom. Lees are really, really important. We've talked about in a past episode about batonnage, which is a technique that you leave, in that case, the wine, and now in some cases cider, on the lees, and you keep on rotating or rolling the barrel, and people have different setups for that, that integrates the juice all around the skins and the pulp, hoping to pull off, in some cases, tannin and color. So, kind of interesting there. And now back with Patrick of Simple Ciders in Tasmania.
And we're just, we're wanting to get a nice round product, which we do get from letting it sit on lees for quite a while.
So, what's the beginning and end time for this particular cider here? You're saying that you leave it on the lees for a while. You're doing two rackings. I'm reiterating what you said because you're kind of going in and out of there, and I'll make sure that the listeners can hear that. No filtration. So what, from the time of pressing, which you're in pressing right now, I suspect, to the time you make it and the time you bottle, how many months are we looking at?
So for the Cox's Orange Pippin, we're generally processing in March, sort of mid to late March, which was the same for this year. And then probably have a couple of weeks of fermentation, and then we'll go to start the maturation process. And depending on how timely we were with the processing, that depends how quickly it'll clarify. You do get a very rapid build-up of pectin with Cox's Orange Pippin, so it might take 2 weeks to clarify. It might take 3 months to clarify. But either which way, we'll let it settle. We'll let it mature. We might get a little bit of stir after having taken it off heavy solids initially, and then we'll let it settle out again. And then in about 2 to 3 months after we're having it settle and clarify, we'll back off for bottling, where we'll prime and then take it into a warm room. Then it'll be another 3 to 4 weeks in the warm room. And then I like to, if possible, let it sit down again after the first conditioning for like another month or so. So the cider that you're drinking now is approximately almost a year old.
Mm-hmm. This packaging, this bottle here is a 500 milliliter, and this particular Cox Orange Pippin is 7.5% alcohol by volume. Is there a cap that you need to kind of meet for the government in Australia with your cider, or can you go higher than 7.5?
You know what? I believe so, but I'm going to hold my hand up and say, I'm not too sure. I'm not planning on making a 11% cider, so I don't think that's it's a problem. I think above 8%, you're kind of considered more, you may be classed as a fruit wine, but I'm not concerned about it.
Mm-hmm. So are most of the ciders that you make, this one's 7.5 and the Granny Smith and Ginger is... Well, that's 8%. I thought it was reading 6%. So are most of the ciders around that range, or are you making any like 4.5% lower, more like a sessionable cider in a way?
Yeah, we are moving towards making something more like a sessionable cider. But given the method that we use, we basically use all of the sugar that's available in the fruit. And so we tend to get those higher alcohols. We may blend in some other things down the track to reduce that a little bit. We're looking at some other apples too to see what we can do with. We've got some cider apples on the go, and we might see if we can come up with something a little bit lower in alcohol.
Mm-hmm. I have two different size bottles here. Is that because the Granny Smith and Ginger was more of a one-off of that particular cider? Or are you typically bottling it in the 500 milliliter?
No, we offer both products in both the 500 and the 330. Mm-hmm. We just thought we'd offer you both just to see what we do. We have found that people tend to prefer the Coxes in the 500, and people, for whatever reason, prefer the Granny Smith in the 330. I think the Granny Smith has a tiny bit of sweetness coming from the ginger, and for people who maybe don't want as traditional a cider, it's a bit more approachable, and they prefer it in a smaller bottle. But that's just what I'm guessing.
Okay. And I'm mainly asking this for all the cider tourists who are going to be flocking your way very shortly and wanting to get some of the simple cider. Well, speaking of which, do you have a tasting room where you're located?
We don't have a tasting room, but we welcome visitors. We, quite often have people contacting us, and we just show them around. We love what we do, and we love showing people what we do. And, we've got a lovely little place, and the view's amazing. We're just right by a river. We can look up and down the valley both ways. It's really lovely.
Are there other cideries in your area close by?
Yeah, we're right in cider country. We're about 7 kilometres down the road from Willie Smith's cider, and then if you go to the other side of the river and around a little bit, there is Hagen cider. Then there's also Frank's cider, and then if you went a bit further down the channel, you've got Red Sail cider.
Yes, I've been hearing about all these cideries. How about that big midwinter festival that happens in July? Is that something that you've been to before, your form of wassail there?
Yeah, it's awesome. It's really good. I'm looking forward to going again this year. Willie Smith has done a great job of making that into an event down in the Huon, and it's awesome. It brings so many people down, gets so many people interested in the area and what we do, and it was fantastic.
Are you seeing an uptick of cider tourists, both from Australia and Tasmania, and how about outside of other countries?
Yeah, we are, and I'm always surprised by that. But yeah, we get people coming through specifically to come see the cideries and so on. And I think it's only going to grow, and I think it's great. I think what we're doing down in the Huon with a few kind of dedicated, focused cider makers, it can only get better.
Is there besides like Cider Australia, is there like a local meetup of cider makers that happens monthly or weekly? What I'm trying to get a sense of your community. I know that there's a lot going on, that Midwinter Festival that happens in July every year. And of course all the cideries, but what is the scene like, just the local cider scene? If I, you know, went to a local pub, would I find cider? And again, getting back to the cider makers, are the cider makers hanging out at a particular spot and or meeting up once a month?
Yeah, well, there's Cider Tasmania, which, you know, meets fairly regularly. There's the Tas Cider Trail, which allows people to come around and meet the various makers. And it's not a big place down here. We all kind of know each other. So, you know, we do see each other fairly regularly socially. You know, it's not uncommon.
So right. Is this a country location or are you in a town?
Well, the cidery and orchard is just on the edge of a small town called Franklin, which is about 50 kilometres outside of Hobart, which is the main city or town in Tasmania. And most of us, you know, live within 20 kilometres of Hobart, so it's really quite easy for us all to catch up.
It's just an amazing topography. Looking at the photos in that book on Tasmania, like the Wine Glass Cove, and the mountains, if you're looking out the window of your cidery or your home, what are you seeing in terms of landscape? Are you seeing mountains? Is it forestry? And what about those little Tasmanian devils?
Yeah, the little Tasmanian devils. Don't see too many of those. They tend to be a little bit shy. But just look straight out my window and there's Mount Wellington, which, you know, it's known as Sleeping Beauty. It's beautiful. It's just really lovely down here. It's beautiful and rolling hills and mountains, you know, wonderful valleys, great rivers, the Port of Hobart. It's just it's lovely to hang around. And you can get into the countryside within 5 minutes of being in town, which is why we're here. It's a really lovely place to live.
It seems like the perfect spot to be living, and from a cider tourist perspective, it seems like a excellent place to go for a trip. The scenery is just kind of like out of Lords of the Ring. I know that was like filmed in New Zealand, but I'm just kind of blown away by the blueness of the water, and it just feels like a super clean area.
We claim to have the cleanest air in the world.
Oh, good for you. And I just want to get back to those Tasmanian devils. I'm holding this little stuffed Tasmanian devil in my hand right now, cute as a button, which looks like a little mini bear with some white spots on it. Are they doing better now? I heard that they kind of found that they were having a difficulty, and are they kind of working that out, that something was kind of affecting their health?
Yeah, there was a disease going on through the population. As far as I know, the government's putting a lot of effort into trying to fix it. I don't know how well that's gone. I suspect it's quite a complicated problem to fix, but the population was affected, but they're still around. But yeah, I think they're getting better.
Okay. And do you have deer and different, animals that you have to protect your orchard from?
Yeah, there's some deer, but it's more the wallabies, the possums, the paddy melons, and the wallabies and paddy melons are kind of like little kangaroos. And they are voracious, and they will go into just about anything. So you have to watch out for them. The deers aren't so much of a problem.
Well, I saw a photo of those like kangaroo-like animals, and do they jump really, really high? Do they jump over the fences?
Yeah, you need to have fences that will be high enough for them not to get through, and strong enough for them not to get through as well. They're pretty determined little things.
Wow, okay. Now, getting back to your cidery, What are you pressing your apples with? Are you using a, well, you're probably not using a basket press. Well, what kind of press are you using?
We're using a basket press.
Oh, that's funny. That's okay. That works.
Yeah. We looked at a few different types of press. Initially, we were using a bladder press, but we moved on to a basket press.
And is it yourself? How many people are working at Simple Ciders? And I also was wondering, is this your full-time work at this point?
I do some other work. At the moment, the Simple Cider team is myself, Emily, Dave, Kerry, Kieran, Will, Tom, who you met, and then our two boys, Tully and Frankie, who are Tasmania's best young cider makers, as far as I can tell.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So you got a good group of folks helping you out there. What are you looking forward to? What's your expectations, like your 5 years down the line for Simple Ciders?
Just to keep growing and enjoying what we do, to be creative in every way possible. We love what we do. We feel as though we're getting better at it with every, you know, passing week and month. And we're just looking forward to making more cider, more interesting cider, some more different types of products, and being part of the Tasmanian cider story, which is a great story, and just playing our part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. What is the sense of what's happening out in the world? When I thought of the opportunity of being able to speak to you in Tasmania, of course, I was like super, super excited. I mean, it's kind of hard for me to think clearly even talking to you now because I'm so excited to be hearing about your scene there. What are you hearing about what's going on in the rest of the world with cider?
Well, I suppose I feel that I hear about, you know, Britain and just cider is through everything, but there's a quite a strong distinction between the more traditional cider apple ciders and then, you know, in France where it's mostly traditional cider stuff, that in America it's a huge industry with lots of different varieties and just a tremendous variety in the approaches taken to making the cider. I just hear that there's a lot of stuff going out there, and I try to learn about it wherever possible.
I was wondering what Tom said when he came back about what he saw in Chicago.
Yeah, Tom was saying that there's some really fun things out there. He actually noticed another little a local brewer had done his beer over there, which I was very impressed by. That guy also makes a cider too, I believe. He's an interesting fellow, actually. And he said that the range of ciders that were at that Chicago festival were just amazing.
Yeah. Do you have cider festivals like that where somebody could, go to a cider fest and try all the different ciders from Tasmania?
I believe there are some festivals, but, you know, we're still very much developing down here in that sort of thing. I'm not aware of a single thing. I say that, but there is something at Willie Smith's. Willie Smith's has a cider weekend where other people's ciders can be shown and so on. But we're still very much growing down here. There aren't many standalone things. We tend to sort of be involved with the larger sort of beer and other beverage festivals. There's Taste Tasmania. There's the Midwinter Festival. Winter Feast, rather. The Midwinter Festival is Willie Smith's. And then there's a few other things, like there's the Gabs up in Sydney and Melbourne. Where a lot of cideries go, that's the Great Australian Beer Spectacular, which was a couple of weekends ago, and quite a few of the cideries from Tasmania went up there. But we're still working on having some more standalone cider events.
You might not have a lot of cider festivals right now, but I know a lot of people are looking at your region and are really excited about what you're doing there. And expecting that there's just going to be a growing number of opportunities for cider makers in Tasmania.
Yeah, there's a lot of opportunities, and there are more producers popping up, which is great because there'll be some bit more competition and friendly rivalry as we encourage each other to make better cider too, which is always a good thing.
That leads me to one more question. Is there a lot of competition? I know that there is like that cider judging in Australia, and that I think does not happen on Tasmania. Do you have some local competitions right now for your cider?
Yeah, there's the Cider Tasmania Awards, which are run by Rotary. Then there's, of course, the Cider Australia Awards. I imagine, but I'm not familiar with the various states have some. And there are various cider festivals up in New South Wales and Victoria and so on, other states of Australia. Mm-hmm. And they have competitions associated.
Well, Patrick, I'm really thrilled to have this opportunity to chat with you today and to really salute you on the work that you're doing and your passion for bringing the apple forward in your cider. While I have you here, I'm going to just open up this Granny Smith and ginger. Let me just open that so everybody could hear that. Oh, yep. And it is.
I love that sound.
Oh, yeah. Here we go.
Cheers, Rhea.
Cheers. Wow. I'm going to clink another glass that I have right here. I think I got a little bit on the little Tasmanian devil. It looks smiling now. I'm smelling the ginger.
He likes it.
I feel like I'm one of the most luckiest Americans around right now with this simple cider in front of me. Wow, that's a very refreshing cider. I've made a number of ciders with ginger myself. I think it just balances so well with the apple. Let me just take another sip here. Yeah, I'm getting that just a little bit of the wild, terroir of your region in there. And that balance between the acidity and the apple. Again, just for Ciderville to know, this was a Granny Smith and ginger at 8%. I'm not feeling that heat at all. Really nicely balanced, not hot at all on the tongue. A very lingering effervescence in my mouth, but not over the top. Really nice, nice small bubbles. It's a delicious. Both of the ciders are absolutely delicious. Well done. Well, it's my evening here, and your day is still way ahead of you, too. Is there anything else that I've missed in this conversation that would be really good for listeners around the world to know about simple ciders that we haven't hit upon? Any other ciders that you have available that we haven't discussed?
Well, no, just watch this space for the Wild Cherry, which we'll be releasing in about a month's time. We think it's really super interesting, and it's a nice contrast from the other ciders that we make for all the people out in Ciderville enjoying your cider and keep trying new and interesting ones, and hope you all have fun.
Thank you so much, Patrick. You take a good care of yourself there with those coming into your winter season slowly but surely, and the best of luck for this year's vintage of ciders.
Cheers, Rhea. We're very, very excited to be talking to you, and it's been a lot of fun. So I hope it's been fun for you, and I'm really glad you enjoyed the cider.
I sure did, Patrick. Thank you so much for sending that my way. Getting a little bit of Tasmania. I mean, those are really actually the first ciders I've had from Australia. And if that's what's to come, holy smoking Joe, we are in for a treat. I hope this gets some of us out there in Ciderville thinking about, when can I next go to Tasmania? Because the pictures there, the landscape, and of course, the people are really, really, a treasure. And they recently had their midwinter festival that's put on by Willie Smith Cider. It's right down the road from Simple Ciders, and you should get on the mailing list for that. That's going to be happening again next year on Friday, July 13th through the 15th. So it looks like a crazy kind of wassail in Tasmania. That is That shouldn't be a bucket list. That should be like, I got to get there now. And if you like to be an outdoor scene and really, like they said, like the cleanest air in the world, you could feel it by just looking at the pictures. Crystal clear waters. Oh, so much to love. And even more to love now that there's cider and cider makers like Patrick and the team there. So thanks again. Really enjoyed it. And we'll be staying in touch. I hope that the wild cherry is coming out to perfection. I know that's a big word to jump to, but we just do our best and keep that barrel rolling along. And I just want to talk about carbonic maceration. You heard that Patrick mentioned that. That's how they're doing the wild cherry. And that's a technique that is used typically with Beaujolais. And I actually have done this technique, don't you know? Making a grape wine where I was taking the local Concord grapes. They grow everywhere around here. In the woods, and there was one big bumper crop year. So my buddy Frank and I, he was kind of leading the team there. We got a whole bunch of grapes, put them in some corny kegs, and a corny keg is like a 5-gallon keg. That's primarily what I use. They're often used by, tapping soda, and it's a vertical tiny little keg. And we stuffed all the grapes in there, we put in yeast, and then we just blanketed it with CO2. And when the wine came out, when we were done with the fermentation stuff, I just let it sit for a couple of years. And normally the grapes in my area are very, very high acidity and a little bit hard to get. So if I make any wine, I'm importing grapes in from probably like California or New York State. And that grape, the Concord grape, was just amazing. So carbonic maceration is a really fun thing to do. He's doing it with cherries. And I don't really consider that a cider. But yeah, I wonder what that'd be like with some of these palms that are out there besides like the apples and pears. So we'll be keeping an eye on that as time goes along. And that's the nice part of all the different folks coming into Ciderville from their different branches of being a maker, such as a winemaker or a brewer, and having that background history and trying it out. That's what it's all about. Okie dokie. Well, before I forget, because I don't want to forget, and these people are so important to Cider Chat, I want to thank the folks who are patrons of Cider Chat. There are 19 of them right now. I'm looking for one more so I could start raffling off to that group the amazing Palm Periodical that was basically commissioned by Bonnie Doon's Vineyard in Santa Cruz, California. That's Randall Graham. They sent me a bunch of these posters to give to folks, and they're going directly to the patrons. There might be, I'm not sure how many I have, but I have a whole bunch, and I'm really excited to start shipping those off. Patreon is a great way to support this chat. I could really use that coming into the fall and need to do some travel to get some really on-site recordings. It was tough doing this recording on Skype with Patrick. He was so easygoing. We had to like hang up and go back again. And it takes me a super long time to edit that kind of chat. It's tough. So I always try to do it in person. And I'm going to be blending a little bit of traveling this fall with my business trip. But after that, it's all on my dime. And the dimes, I mean, not even the dimes are rolling in right now for Cider Chat. So I could use a bit of help there. And the patrons who have been holding this podcast for so long, support them in a way too by joining in on that community. You get some nice little kickback and know that you're really helping cider grow around the world. And if you're a commercial cidery like Current Cider in Pennsylvania, who is probably getting pretty close to building their new location in Philadelphia, in the Fishtown location of Philadelphia, they are longtime supporters of the Cider Going Up campaign. So you could also join that too. Just go to ciderchat.com or Google Patreon Cider Chat and you find it there. Or heck, if you can't find it, just send me an email, ria@ciderchat.com. I will do whatever I can to help you help this podcast. And I sure do hope it's helping you. Boy, these kinds of chats and the ones coming up, they're just fantastic, aren't they? I get so much information, just like, Joby was saying. He really breaks it down to the technical podcast, to the more informative ones. It's tons of fun. All right. Well, I think that's it for this week. I'm going to roll on out of here and wish you the best until we chat soon. This is Rhea Wincaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Going up, going up.
Yeehaw!